Hello, and welcome to Sideways, a podcast about addiction, recovery, and friendship. I'm Graham Landy, and I'm a psychotherapist. And each week, I'm going to be chatting to my longtime friend, Martin Pankhurst, a recovering alcoholic and trustee of a charity that helps others in their recovery from addiction. We're going to be talking about normal things and the experiences we've had in the 40-odd years we've been friends to help us and you understand why we self-destruct, how to stop it, and instead choose a fulfilling and enjoyable life. We hope you enjoy it, so let's get started. Episode 1, Beginnings.
On YouTube, we're actually in the in the studio.
Yeah.
Obviously, they've got mics right up here with the things that the stop the popping and all that.
Pop filter, I think, is the phrase you're looking for.
And they sound rather nice.
But yeah, but that's if you're doing a proper podcast.
It is.
Rather than one round your dining room table iPhone.
Yeah, I know, but I like dining room tables, don't you?
Well, this one's okay. It's a bit wobbly.
Feels comfortable, though, doesn't it?
It is comfortable.
I feel comfortable talking at it.
Good.
Yeah.
Welcome to the first episode of our new podcast, Sideways. So let's start by introducing ourselves. Well, I'm Graham. I'm a psychotherapist and I run my own practice here in Maidstone.
I'm Martin. I'm a recovering alcoholic and I'm a trustee and founding trustee of a charity that we set up for running peer support groups for those in recovery from alcohol and drug addictions.
Mm. So when we were thinking about putting this podcast together, one of the things you've always said is that you felt that the thing that's missing for people in recovery is any sort of psychotherapeutic help. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that it's a real necessity, and it's something that's really missing. I know that the funding issues surrounding recovery are always under scrutiny, and they're always being reduced down. It's not much of a vote winner, really, and politically, I think it's something which is well down at the bottom of the agenda. But I think to get recovery properly under control, it's not just about stopping. It's the staying stopped, which snipers a lot of people.
Mm.
And psychotherapeutic help. I mean, obviously, you were a great help to me in my early days and continue to be so. I'm lucky to have access to someone like you. Whereas I know a lot of people in the groups that I've run and have been party to have had real problems getting any sort of help. We know that that the state-funded help is a very short-term, sort of 6 to 10 weeks stint in front of the psychotherapist or psychiatrist. And they're often waiting up to 6 to 12 months for that even to start.
Mm.
And I think the boat's being missed.
Mm.
I really do. And I think that hopefully we can perhaps with these podcasts fill some of those little gaps.
Yeah, so
that I know I'm missing.
So when we were thinking about talking about addiction, I know one of the other conversations that we've had is that in one way or another we're kind of all addicts, aren't we? You know, we're addicted to our behaviours, the destructive and damaging ones.
Yeah, we are. I know that we've sort of talked about this before. I don't know if you wanted to explain or go on a bit more as to how that, because I just see addict as someone that's addicted to an addictive substance,
like drugs or alcohol. Yeah, I suppose I think of it in terms of how we're addicted to our behaviours, how we're addicted to damaging or toxic relationships that we stay in, how we're addicted to even our emotional states, our anger, our stress, our depression. We're addicted to our shyness or our lack of assertiveness or even our, you know, feelings of grandiosity. So, you know, in that sense, you can think about this addiction as being something quite narrow that appeals to quite a narrow band of people. But actually, if you think about addiction more widely, you know, we're all one way or another engaged in things that really don't do us very much good, but we continue to do. So basically, the way that we're going to work this, I think, is we said we were going to talk about different subjects every week. You're going to kind of bring a subject to us,
yeah,
and we're going to look at it and think about what it tells us about addiction and perhaps more widely the human condition and ways in which that might resonate with people generally.
No, I'm happy with that. I was watching, do you remember on Soccer AM, I don't know if you're watching the days when Helen Chamberlain was comparing it.
And, no, I never watched it in those days.
And there's a guy called Tubes on it. Do you remember Tubes?
Tubes is still on
it. Tubes is still on it. Right, yeah. Okay. I haven't seen it for some time. But I watched a little clip on YouTube about his addiction problems. I didn't realise that he had addiction problems, but I think there's quite a nice phrase that was brought up by the guy that was interviewing the question was, when did your hobby become a problem? And I thought that's quite a nice transition, because looking back, that transitional point is very blurry for most addicts. I'm sure it is for me, to pinpoint when you've tipped over that you've gone over from that.
So it must be something you've thought about.
I've thought about it since I've watched that, but it was something that I'd thought about a long time ago and sort of wondered whether it was relevant.
Yeah, I mean, something we've spoken about before is, when I look back at it now, some of your behaviour around drinking was was somewhat erratic.
Yeah.
Even many years ago. I mean, yes. You've spoken about how you suddenly used to just disappear, didn't you, from the pub?
I did.
You never used to say goodbye. You just sort of ghost away.
And I did.
Almost, it became your kind of party piece, and it became something that's quite funny. But
then
it was years later before you actually told me what you were doing.
Yeah.
What were you doing?
What was I mean, I'd got to the point. I mean, it was still early on in my drinking. I don't like to call it a career because that gives it some sort of gravitas. But it was when the problem. It was still a hobby at that point, I'd say.
Mm.
Going back to my previous phrase, it was still a hobby, but it was becoming. It was becoming more of an issue. It started to impact. I could feel it was impacting on the way that I dealt with things. It was impacting because I know when I used to do that disappearing trick, it would often be perhaps I was popping in for a couple of beers on the way home from work, and I knew I had to get home at some point to go and see to my then wife, and I knew that if I didn't make the break at that point, if I didn't make the break and go away from that situation when I was drinking, I would have been stuck there for an awful long time. Now, it was that sort of control that I had at that point in my drinking days that I didn't have later on. So I'd disappear, so people wouldn't offer me another drink. I wouldn't get stuck into the routine of... I knew pretty much that after I'd had a couple of drinks, I was well on the way to not wanting to go home at all. And I knew that I was stuck in that point where I thought, if I don't go now, I'm definitely going to have a problem getting home later on.
Yeah, and then you also, I think you said to me once that if you were out for the evening with us, you'd still disappear because you'd get frustrated that we weren't drinking quick enough.
Oh, yeah.
You need to go to another pub where you can drink a bit quicker.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that comes up regularly when you talk to other addicts. It really is. I know whenever I went to like a dinner dance, for example, where there's a crowd of people, say if there's a crowd of 12 on a table, I would take charge of the drinks. I would write the lists of who wanted what, and I'd be then in control of when the drinks were purchased. So I could get them set up at my pace. Yeah, at the end of the night, people might have had three or four drinks on the table that they hadn't touched, which again, to someone in my position, I could do a little bit of sweeping at the end of the night, you know. But it, not only that, it meant if I went to the bar with my list and the whip, I could then put a few extra quid in and have a drink whilst I was standing there. So effectively, I was having drinks between rounds as well.
So the other thing that kind of illustrates is, you know, I've known you for over 40 years, haven't I?
Yeah, yeah.
And if
you
think back across your life,
yeah,
okay, you might not be able to pinpoint the moment at which your drinking flipped over from a hobby into a problem, but, you know, directionally, how many years would you go back before, you know, to find the point where you'd say, I think my drinking probably was an issue back then? How many years back would you go?
I would go back probably... I reckon that 40-year mark, and I'm not saying that's when I sort of became friends with you, my drinking started.
Yeah,
don't take that as a problem there. I think it was earlier than that anyway.
So longer than 40 years ago?
Yeah, I would say that I knew that the feeling that it gave me in my very early teens when I started to drinking was what I wanted.
So the reason I asked the question is because This is another kind of interesting thing, which is you can know someone for years and years and years and years and years, and you can not know that kind of massive thing about them, that they've got this issue that either is bubbling under or it's raging. And, you know, I mean, we've discussed before that alcoholics are notoriously resourceful. They're very good at hiding stuff. And so it's a little, it's quite scary actually to think that you can know someone for so long and not have any kind of real visibility of that massive influence over their life.
I think most addicts would fall into the category where being resourceful is one of the issues, but being I suppose not telling the truth to people, and certainly not telling the truth to yourself, but you hold on to this. The last thing you want is for someone to say, "Do you have a drink problem, or are you drinking too much?" So you go to the ends of the earth to protect your image, to protect the hold the addiction has on you, but you protect the fact that you want to continue.
So you're still protecting it even when you've got to the point where you know quite clearly you've got a problem with alcohol.
Oh yeah, very much so.
When you're living in a village and you're having to go to separate shops, so
yes,
so they don't start to be suspicious of the fact that you're going and buying vodka every day.
That's it. Yes, I mean that image. It comes back to being as the drinking gets worse, you're still a functioning alcoholic, and all the time you're functioning, you're holding down a job, etc. You as the disease progresses or the condition progresses, you become more resourceful, but you're very conscious that people don't pull you up on it. You're very conscious about what your image at that stage, and that's not just me. That comes out a lot in the groups. Yeah. It's something that everyone wants to protect because they know the minute that someone pulls them up on it or admit to themselves that they've got a problem, you've got to deal with it.
So even in situations where really it's pretty obvious to people that you've got a problem, if they're not actually speaking it, you can kind of maintain this denial.
Yeah, you can. But I think you become, as your drinking progresses, you also get paranoia creep in. And that paranoia is normally associated with people that take other sorts of drugs and smoke weed, but the paranoia is very evident, and certainly I remember it dominating my thought pattern.
So just on that kind of the subject of trying to maintain your the image of you as a social drinker rather than a problem drinker, what's your view of interventions? So what's it like for an addict if someone says, "Listen, I know you've got a drink problem"? What's that like? What do you think that's like for someone to be confronted with that? Because you know you've described how addicts work very, very hard not to get to that point.
Yeah.
So what happens when it does confront you?
When someone confronts you about it, it's straight to denial.
Yeah.
Obviously, and that maintaining of the image becomes even stronger, because so the minute that someone mentions it to you, you redouble your efforts.
So it pushes you underground.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah,
it does. I mean, interventions. I mean, the local recovery hub, they've had over the years with varying success intervention units. So people would go out on an intervention on the behest of normally partners, husbands, wives, etc., to go and see people. But to get people from that stage of being someone being worried around them to them actually doing something about it is a long struggle.
Yeah, you know, as I've said to you before, it's like someone telling someone to come to therapy.
Yeah,
it doesn't work.
No one likes being told what to do.
No.
I mean, certainly not when it's something that is dominating your life. In such a major part of your life that if someone dares to try and take that away from you, you're going to defend it at all costs.
Yeah.
Even though you know deep down that it's doing you wrong, the reason you stay there is because you can't see a life without it.
Yeah. And that's a pretty dark place to be.
It is a dark place to be. There was another quote that I came across the other day, which I hadn't heard before, but which was trying to explain to people that don't have addiction problems what the initial rush is when you first get a, when you first get into taking drugs or drinking to excess. They explained it to, or the quote was really, if you're driving on a car and it's raining hard and it's really noisy and you suddenly go under a bridge and all of a sudden for a few seconds you've got this calm and then you're out the other side and back into the noise again. Now that bridge represents really how you feel when you first start to take drugs or we start to drink. Just that moment of serenity before you hit life again. And it's that what we chase. We chase that moment under the bridge.
Yeah, because the moment under the bridge is relief.
It is, yeah.
It's a metaphor, actually.
It is. Yeah,
it's
yeah,
like
yeah,
it's yeah. For those few seconds you don't have to feel, do you?
You don't have to
kind of hear the rain on the car. You can block it out. That's what you are literally doing. You're literally blocking out.
You are. And the quote was used by a heroin addict because it is a very quick hit and then you're back out into reality after a while. Mm. But I thought it was quite a nice way of explaining it, really.
Mm.
And someone that most people can relate to.
So actually, in that same sense, that means that the prospect of moving from addiction into recovery is having to tolerate the rain hammering down on the roof all the time.
Yeah, you have to learn to dance in the storm, as they say, and I think that you come to terms with it. So the avoiding, you can't stay under that bridge forever. And that's what I tried to do. I wanted that bridge to be forever. I never wanted to come out the other side.
Mm.
And that's what you know. But to maintain that, you've got to effectively remain drunk or high for 24 hours.
And just on that subject, what was it that caused you to come out the other side?
What caused me to come out the other side? In my case, it was I had an illness.
But that wouldn't be enough to bring everybody out the other side?
No, it wasn't initially. I'd had enough of feeling poorly. I'd had enough of having to chase the it's very stressful being an addict. There's nothing nice about it. When it gets to that point where it dominates every moment of every day, there's nothing pleasurable about it. Some people see addiction as a sort of moral malaise and you're partying the whole time. You're really not. That finished a long time ago before it gets to the real problem.
So what do you think it is that keeps people in the stress and the chaos of addiction?
Not being able to see a life without it.
Yeah, so it's like the pain that you're in,
yeah.
At least it's familiar.
It's familiar, yeah.
And the prospect of coming out of that familiar pain means you've got to go somewhere unknown.
Yeah.
And there's always that chance it could be worse.
Yeah. That's certainly with physical... Do you see that with people?
With other sorts
of things? The reason they stay in that comfort zone is because it's comfortable.
It is comfortable. It's painfully comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, it's familiar.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you get up every day, it's shit, but at least... It's your shit.
Yeah.
And I think we massively underestimate what a powerful motivation that is. You know, just to, I'll stay where I am because it's bad, but at least I know what it's like. Which is tragic, but true.
It is true. It is true. And with addiction, you've got the extra layer, the fact that... you really do feel like you're at the bottom of a well.
Yeah,
and the sides are very sharp, and there is a little bit of light right up the top there, but you've got no way of reaching that. And to be honest, you get to the point where you're so far down in the well, you don't want to. You start to give up hope of ever climbing out of it.
Yeah, I'm sitting here now wishing you hadn't given me that mental image of you dancing in the storm, because that's what I'm kind of trying to get out of my head.
Me personally dancing in a storm?
Yeah, when you told me that, I had this image of you dancing in the storm. It's disturbing. Yeah.
It's pretty uncomfortable to me. I mean, I'm a guy. We can't really dance that well, can we?
Not really.
In fact, when you're drunk, you think you can. I just thought of that. I thought I was a brilliant dancer when I was drunk.
Yeah, you weren't.
And no, I wasn't. Yeah. No. I was obviously very, very bad.
Okay, well, I think we're probably about out of time there.
So, sorry about that abrupt ending there, but, you know, editing is a learning curve. Sideways was created by Graham Landy and Martin Pankhurst. If you want to read more about our work, visit grahamlandywellbeing.co.uk/sideways. You can follow us on Twitter and you can email us to let us know what you thought of the show and with any questions that you might have for us. Finally, we want to thank you for listening and ask that if you've enjoyed what you've heard, that you tell someone about it. Somebody once said that change happens one person at a time, so you're probably a lot more important than you think you are. We'll see you next week.